Welcome to Bewildered. I'm Martha Beck, here with Rowan Mangan. At this crazy moment in history, a lot of people are feeling bewildered, but that actually may be a sign we're on track. Human culture teaches us to come to consensus, but nature, our own true nature, helps us come to our senses. Rowan and I believe that the best way to figure it all out is by going through bewilderment into bewilderment. That's why we're here. For almost 30 years, I've been teaching people to do something that I call reading your internal compasses. I believe we are all born with direction-finding mechanisms that are inherent in us and will help us find our best destiny. A few years ago, though, I realized that a lot of people were getting very, very anxious. And this is true. Anxiety is going nuts all over the planet. So I spent 5 years researching and writing a book about how to read your compasses and lower the anxiety that's getting between you and your right life. And I'm very excited about the book. It's coming out in 2025, but I would love to teach you about it before the book comes out. So this summer, I'm doing a course called The Wayfinder's Compass, Moving Beyond Anxiety. And you can check it out by going to marthabeck.com/compass. And we will have a fabulous time putting you on course for your North Star. Hi, I'm Martha Beck.
And I'm Rowan Mangan, and this is another episode of Bewildered. You know it, the podcast for people trying to, that's right, figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So how you doing, Marty?
For someone who has figured nothing out, I am tolerably well, thank you. And you?
Tolerably well. You can tolerate your own wellness.
Barely. How about you?
Yeah, I'm good. I haven't had enough sleep lately.
No kidding.
Don't know if I've mentioned it to you 2 or 3 times an hour for the last week, but yeah, been on a little insomnia jag.
As you crawl from room to room, it really has been bad.
The one good thing about it is that complaining always makes it better.
There's nothing that complaining doesn't make better, right?
Absolutely.
Complaining and 4,000 milligrams of caffeine.
So much caffeine. Oh my God, so much caffeine. But don't worry, Marty. We've got this.
Uh-huh. All right. I'm not sure what we've got. Probably the virus that Lila's been dealing with that keeps you up at night. But whatever we've got, we've got it. We've got this. So what are you trying to figure out in a broader, more philosophical sense?
I don't know. You. Always you. One way or another. You're a puzzle. You're an enigma. And you're also like super cute.
Oh,
an enigma
you.
Wrapped in bacon. That just grossed me out as I said it. I wish I hadn't said it. I wish I
and
could time travel.
It's my beauty secret. Continuously wrapping myself in bacon.
Be a great blurb for your next book. We could just get Liz Gilbert or someone to just write, Martha Beck is an enigma wrapped in bacon.
Enfolded by aluminum foil, yes.
Enfolded.
Sweetly enveloped.
Yeah. So this is my cute little story for the listeners about you for the week.
Dear.
Because I want them to know, because you kind of play a bit of a persona on this podcast, and I just want them to know that it is absolutely not contrived and 100% just what you're like. So a friend of ours had a birthday this past week.
True.
And we wanted to go get her some flowers. So we looked at our little chores and who had the time and who had the car, and you were nominated to be the one to go pick up the flowers.
For
it's a
once.
Big responsibility.
Because everyone, no one trusts me to drive. Let's just make that clear. Nobody trusts me to drive. So, yeah.
They were dire circumstances.
They were desperate. They let me have the keys.
So off you went to get the flowers. And as you sort of guiltily confessed later on, you didn't just go and get flowers, did you?
What did I do? Am I a werewolf?
You told us that you did go and get the flowers. You absolutely did. You are trustworthy. You picked up the flowers. But then you remembered that someone had told you that at the canal nearby there were beavers.
Well, yeah.
And so you sort of told me later that night, I didn't just go to get the flowers and come home. I went off to look for beavers.
I did.
And you were like, but there was nowhere to park, so I parked illegally. And you were so scared about getting a ticket or something because we'd entrusted you with the sacred flower mission that you had to check on the beavers, so you had to park illegally. So you didn't want to get a ticket, so you raced to the beavers in order to quickly check on them and then get back to the car.
The alleged beavers. I did not see them. I sprinted to the alleged beaver location.
I thought you saw one of them now.
Well, that was later because I've been back.
Of course you have. But this is the first I've heard of it.
Yeah. So the other day when I had to do something like medical, I thought, well, you know, doctor's appointments take a little extra time. So I parked legally.
Uh-oh.
Took quite a little jog to the alleged beaver location and just crouched there. Oh, Rowie, there's a pile of sticks. They've made a pile of sticks. And I just sat there and looked at the pile of sticks. And there were fish jumping. And I thought, this is magical. And I just squatted there on my haunches the way I do. And in the middle of just sitting there, I hear this. And from under the pile of sticks came a little furry head.
Oh.
And swim around for me.
Was it? It might have been Joshua the stuffed monkey, because I made that mistake with Lila once. A little furry head came along and I thought it was our daughter, and it turned out just to be Joshua the inanimate monkey toy.
If I had thought of it, I would have taken Joshua the stuffed monkey and sacrificed him by throwing him into the beaver dam just to like as bait, like a decoy. I would have sacrificed anything to see that beaver.
I love the idea that in your world, a stuffed monkey is beaver bait.
This is so, we are skating so close to the edge. Wait, no. Sailing so close to the wind. I don't know what that means, but they say it. Skating on thin ice. We are skating so close to the wind right now because of the unfortunate
yes, we don't have to say it.
Yeah, we don't have to say it.
Let's just leave it. Let's be grown-ups about this and just let it be there without having to pick at it.
Yeah. But being lesbians, it's, I'm just going to leave it there. I'm not saying a thing. I will just say I would sacrifice any of our daughter's toys to see another beaver.
Maybe on your birthday, honey.
What is wrong with us?
Buddy, for God's sake.
I just like animals.
Dig us out of this hole. What are you trying to figure out?
I'm trying to figure out, you know, I've started drawing and painting a lot, as you know, because it's the thing I love most in the world. And what seems to surprise you and Karen is that part of what I love most in the world is to go into an absolutely tyrannical rage, like a 2-year-old, when I can't get something to look the way I want it.
And it's dark, guys. It's not like how she's cute, like when she's telling stories like this. It's like, it's quite scary energy when Martha goes into an art rage.
A watercolor rage, especially because you can't erase watercolor. And I have a friend who's an artist. Actually, it's one of my children. And so that might be why she also goes into a rage when she's doing her art. She's really good. And we bonded over our art rage the other day. But then it's worse because with the internet, I can actually go on and I see these brilliant artists and they post videos explaining how to do things, which I've never had in my life. I totally self-taught except for like one class. And the thing is that artist videos will drive you mad because they're in the right side of their brains, right? And that does two things. It takes out time, so they're not aware time is passing, and it takes out language, so they can't talk.
These are like live videos of people painting and supposedly talking about what they're doing and explaining.
Yes, and what it is 45 minutes of dab, 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 dab. Well, now, dab, 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 dab. You see how I, dab, dab. Oh, okay, wait, no. All right, dab, dab, dab. You can fix that. I'm speeding this up, actually. This is like over an hour and a half. Now you're going to see some magic. Dab, 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 dab. Never say another word about it.
I could be a TikTok sensation by secretly filming you in an art rage because it's a very different sort of energy from what you're describing there.
It's indescribable. And then you're trying to watch this person who has no sense of time and no language, who purports to be teaching you what to do to get out of your art rage. And it just makes you homicidal along with, I don't know what the art rage does. It makes you want to just become a hurricane and destroy everything.
Wow.
But then you get it to work and it's totally worth it. It's like, oh, yeah, heaven.
She has this whole other life.
Heaven.
Amazing. Heaven. Well, I'm sure you'll figure it out, my love.
I doubt that, but I'm going to keep trying because that's what we do, because we're bewildered.
Yeah. We'll be right back with more Bewildered. I have a favor to ask. You might not know this, but ratings and reviews are like gold in the podcasting universe. They get podcasts in front of more faces, more eyes, more ears, all the bits that you could have a podcast in front of, that's what they do. So it would help us enormously if you would consider going over to your favorite podcasting app, especially if it's Apple, and giving us a few stars, maybe even 5, maybe even 6. If you can find a way to hack the system, I wouldn't complain. And a review would also be wonderful. We read them all and love them. So thank you very much in advance. Let's just go out there and bewilder the world. Mwah.
For almost 30 years, I've been teaching people to do something that I call reading your internal compasses. I believe we are all born with direction-finding mechanisms that are inherent in us and will help us find our best destiny. A few years ago, though, I realized that a lot of people were getting very, very anxious. And this is true. Anxiety is going nuts all over the planet. So I spent 5 years researching and writing a book about how to read your compasses and lower the anxiety that's getting between you and your right life. And I'm very excited about the book. It's coming out in 2025, but I would love to teach you about it before the book comes out. So this summer, I'm doing a course called The Wayfinder's Compass, Moving Beyond Anxiety. And you can check it out by going to marthabeck.com/compass. And we will have a fabulous time putting you on course for your North Star. And what is our topic?
Today, yeah, let's get to it. So we're always talking about anxiety one way or another, aren't we, Marty?
Well, even if we're not talking about it, it's always there, right?
It's always the subtext.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, we're anxious little bunnies. And but now it's kind of fun to be an anxious bunny because Marty's working on a book about anxiety. And so we're learning all about it. We're thinking all about it. We're talking all about it. And yeah. And all your research is so amazing.
I know. So we thought, well, let's do it. There are many aspects of it, actually. It's a very big topic. So we thought, let's do some episodes about this and write a book and teach a course and do all the things. But this episode is our first anxiety episode so far.
I mean, in a way, they've all been anxiety episodes for me, but it's just in a subtextual way. I think we've probably actually talked about anxiety quite a lot.
Oh, you think? But it's like breathing.
Yeah. It is. Deep breath. Nice long deep breath.
But here's the thing, you know, we need to talk about it because it's going so completely ballistic in the entire human population around the world. Anxiety disorders are just climbing and climbing and climbing and climbing. So there's a fair chance that some of y'all out there listening have a little bit of struggle with this issue.
Yeah. Yeah. So this topic today, though, is kind of, I don't know, it's slightly adjacent to it because this is more like something that we've noticed about life that has to do with anxiety, I guess, and just how we do life and how anxiety does us in life kind
yes,
of thing.
Yes, it does.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I keep having conversations with people who are looking for a sense of safety, and they're looking for a sense of safety the way I look for beavers. Like, it's something out there. And I really, really, really need to find it. And it's not readily apparent. And I don't even really know its tracks. And I don't know how to create it. And it seems to actually increase the anxiety as they're looking for a sense of safety. And what I know from the research I'm doing is that the way they're looking for safety is actually increasing their anxiety. And so you and I were talking about this and we thought we should say this on Bewildered.
Yeah. It's fascinating. I don't know if this is a digression or not, but you know, I feel like there's this weird continuum in our culture, which is whatever. I'm not going to define our culture. You know what I'm talking about, just vaguely American.
Go back to the episodes where Western.
God, I'm so sick of trying to do that. I'm sorry, everyone. Where you start at safety and it like slides on this long spectrum to a point where it's more like convenience. And it's like, so I think about convenience all the time, about how like the more convenient our lives get, the harder it becomes to tolerate inconvenience. I mean, people have heard me go on about cup holders on this show before.
We're back to the cup holders.
All right, look, I have feelings about cup holders. I don't try to hide it. I also don't try to bring it up every time I think of it. But like, think about in the cart at the supermarket, there's a cup holder in the cart. I mean, genius, but also totally debilitating for us. Once you have taken your coffee to the supermarket and found a cup holder for it, to push it around in your cart. The next time you come, if there's no cup holder in that cart and you've got your coffee in your hand, you're screwed.
Right?
Like, you might as well just leave. Forget about
it. Yeah, and it's like, what? No cup holder?
And you don't know what to do anymore. And it's just like, it's all bound up with the kind of, as companies compete against each other, they're like, everything's so the same that they're just trying to, the only competitive edge so often is slightly more convenient way of doing things. and slowly it's just getting to a point where we can't do anything for ourselves. And I feel like this is analogous to how anxiety works. And there's all kinds of reasons at the moment where, you know, we can get to our point where the tolerance that we have for the discomfort of anxiety starts to actually inhibit how we act, how we're prepared to live, the risks we're prepared to take, the amount of vulnerability that we're prepared to show, and so on.
Right.
And so, you know, there's a lot of different reasons for that. But, you know, I think a lot of it recently is technology and how much we can do. I mean, we joke on this show about how we never leave our house, and we never do.
We don't. We really
except
don't,
for beaver it? Hunting.
Well, yeah. That's true of any. No, I'm not going down that road.
No, that's what she said.
No, it's true. There's so much. We're doing this in our house right now. Like, we're talking to all the peoples in our house. Why go anywhere? It's so convenient. And it really is convenient.
It also feels safe.
Exactly. You feel safe. You're in your little cubby hole. And you, by the way, are constantly trying to make smaller cubby holes. Now you're obsessed with moving into a van.
I want to do a whole episode on that. Let's not.
Oh, at first it was tiny houses, but those aren't tiny enough. Now she wants vans. I'm going to get a little dog crate for you and just crate train you because you'd be so happy there.
I could make it so cute in there.
Have all your supplies along the road. Anyway, there's a point here, and that is that the smaller the space you occupy in terms of your activities in the world, the smaller the space where you feel safe. So during the pandemic, anxiety just zipped up. It went up 25% in the year 2020 alone around the world, right? 25%. Like the rapidity of that increase is unheard of. When I first read that, I thought, well, of course, everyone's afraid of getting sick and dying, losing their relatives, supply chain problems and everything like that. There is stuff to be afraid of. But then I've been writing about this, and yet it wasn't till we were talking about the convenience thing earlier that I saw, oh, wait, what has been happening as people went into lockdown is increasing mobility in the same way that agoraphobia develops in the human brain. Okay, so this is something, I do have a point. There's something that you can Google, every psychologist in the world knows about this, called the anxiety cycle. And the way it works is that somebody has a difficult experience. Let's use the classic example. Agoraphobia means fear of the marketplace. So being in a crowded space is usually the first place that triggers a panic.
It's probably just because they forgot to put the cup holders in the cart in the marketplace.
No cup holder! I'm never leaving the house. So what happens is that the human brain, so good at making connections, connects the feeling of panic with that place. So later, people start to avoid that place. It becomes very frightening for them. But the human brain is just, it just generates fear in certain conditions. And so they're going to have another panic attack and they'll be in a different place. Say this time it's at a friend's house. They'll stop going to that friend's house. Then they'll stop going to any friend's house. Then they start to get worried when they are in a car, no more cars. Then they start to get panicky when they're outside the house and even different rooms in the house. And I've known people who were stuck in one room, like a bedroom, bathroom combo, for literally years. And the thing is, no matter how tiny you make the space, that space becomes frightening. Mm. But going out of the space, because you are so frightened, feels undoable, feels suicidal. And it's not rational. And people who have it know it's not rational, but it happens. And when everyone started staying in their houses, I think our comfort zones shrank. Literally, as our physical mobility shrank.
It's so funny how the agoraphobia example is like, it's a metaphor and it's also a literal kind of factor.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's so weird that you're just pointing to my like tiny house and van life obsession as part of this. But isn't it cool that if you live in a van, don't worry, I'm not going to go on about it for too long, but I just want to say, like, if you live in a van and you have a teeny little space and you got your little bed there and it's all, and you can drive off anywhere and then still go like retreat in, go out, retreat in, at least it's like mobile agoraphobia. Like agoraphobia on the road. That's going to be my Instagram handle.
That's it.
Yeah.
Rowan Mangan, agoraphobia on the road. To all the people out there who are suffering from this, we are not mocking it. It is a horrible experience, and more and more people are having it, and we're not mean to laugh at you. We're just laughing with you.
Oh my God, no. It's horrible. Anxiety sucks. Yeah. Can I just be the first to say?
Mm-hmm.
Anxiety sucks and no one is disputing that.
Yeah.
Just
in terms of mobility, it reminded me of the tire shredder analogy.
Oh, good. Yeah, I was thinking that because there's a thing that happens not just in the world, but the way that our brains work and don't work that exacerbates this tendency, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and it has to do with the way we focus on the left hemisphere more than the right hemisphere. That's really involved with it. But what it does basically is there's a little bit of the brain that has an alarm response to something unfamiliar in the left hemisphere. And then that alarm response goes straight to the whole brain, obviously. It goes straight to the whole body and creates a fight, flight, fawn response. But in humans, we have a cortex that can tell stories about the feeling of fear. So what happens is that you see something unfamiliar, there's a spark of fear, which is not based on anything rational. It's a deep animal instinctual sense of fear. But then the human part of your brain goes, oh, there's a reason for this. I'm going to make up an excuse for why I'm afraid. I'm afraid because it's a cloudy day. And I just don't like rain. I'm afraid of thunderstorms or whatever. And it's so interesting because when they do brain studies and they show an image to the right side of the brain, but the left side can't see it. And then they ask, okay, sorry, let me
this
just
This is
set
getting
this up.
Very dense. And yeah. I don't see a tire shredder in sight.
This is the thing. The left side of the brain makes up reasons for whatever is going on inside it. And right. If there is a fear response for any reason, it will say, you should be afraid. This is a rational fear, and it will find something to be afraid of. Like, that person's looking at me strangely, and I'm afraid of them, and it's because they are thinking this, 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 and this. So right. We make up danger. And what that does is instead of it just going out the way it would with a nonverbal animal, the verbal story feeds back in to the primitive part that sparks fear, and it increases the fear.
Oh, and like if you're looking at me weird, and I'm more likely to attach a story to that which is already a bias that I have. Like you are looking at my double chin and thinking thoughts about it. And so then not only am I afraid, I'm also validated in a belief for a reason to be afraid.
Yeah. And then you'll believe that I am somehow thinking negative thoughts about you, and you may, and that will increase the amount of fear. So you'll think, you know, she's always judging me anyway. Like, and then the fight instinct will come in again. And then that story makes you really inflamed. And then you're more afraid that person is really monstrously threatening. And it creates what is known as an unregulated feedback cycle, where it, what goes up never comes down.
So you get more anxious and you never get less anxious.
That's correct. So the fear feeds, the spark feeds into the verbal story, and the verbal story feeds the spark, and it becomes this conflagration that you believe is real. And because we also have something called a negativity bias, we're always looking for what's dangerous. And when you get the combination of those two, the negativity bias that's always looking for danger, and then this cycle of anxiety that never lets it come down, just keeps driving it up, you have a recipe for massive, sustained, horrific anxiety. And people, I think this is happening to millions, billions of people.
Tire shredder. Keyword, tire shredder.
Oh, yeah, right. Okay, so tire shredders, if you're unfamiliar, they're like these fangy, teethy metal things that are at like the exit of a parking garage or whatever, and it will say, do not back up, severe tire damage. So if you drive forward across them, they all lie down flat, and you drive over them, but then they rear up again.
And if you're not helping people's anxiety, picture teeth, metal teeth rising out of the ground.
They rear up again, so if you back up, they will just eat the crap out of your tires. So anxiety works like a tire ripper. You go forward into more and more and more and more and more anxiety, but you can't back up easily. You, because the fear itself says, if you don't stay afraid, you are really in danger.
Right.
And I've actually had clients say to me, my intense anxiety is the only thing keeping me safe.
It's amazing how self-evident that even sounds, like the culture around anxiety.
Yes.
And because the culture and the psychology reinforce each other in this way, like you've just described the neuromechanics of it, and it all suits, it all fits well together, culture and biology.
Yeah,
type
by all,
you know, that I don't really like to talk about. But what I do want to talk about in the context of like how anxiety works and how messed up it is that we tend towards greater and greater anxiety and don't really have a reverse ability to reverse back into calm in a direct way. That I like talking about courage in the face of anxiety. You know, I don't feel like we talk about courage enough.
And we certainly don't talk about it. I bet if you did a content analysis of all the media and all the infinite texts and everything, I bet anxiety would come up a lot more often than the word courage.
Because I think like so the thinking that we've been describing with that sort of example of agoraphobia is like the anxiety that leads you to listen to it and inhibit your behavior. And then, you know, and then it can ramp up in the way you were just describing. But like, and then we can talk about, you know, meditation or whatever, calm down the anxiety. And that's quite different from sort of stepping towards the anxiety. And that's sort of what we thought we'd talk about today with courage. There's a beautiful quote from Anais Nin who says, life shrinks or expands in proportion to one's courage. And when you think about that example of now I can't go, you know, to my friend's house, now I can't go to the living room. That's about life shrinking. And that's not to say that agoraphobics don't have courage or anything like it, but we're just kind of playing with that today, that idea.
Well, it's kind of like in the Divine Comedy, there are places where Dante is going through and Virgil's ghost is his guide. And there are places where Virgil comforts him and says it's going to be okay. And then he gets to certain places where he says, you're just going to need courage for this one. I can't soften this one for you. You're going to have to, you know, just bring all your courage, because that's the only thing you can go on anymore. And there comes a point when you get anxious enough about enough things that courage is your final, it's the last straw. It's the last hope, but it's a big hope. It's a huge hope.
Yeah, but you're risking. I mean, what's the greater risk? You know, it's that kind of question, right? You know, sort of wanted to talk a little bit about like how that looks for us. So, because we're talking about tolerance for the discomfort of anxiety, that sort of thing. So, my areas in my life where my tolerance will like shrink really fast, like I avoid one situation and I notice that my comfort zone is smaller, you know, that I have to keep pushing back against. You know, for me, there's like situations where I have a fear of embarrassment, or a fear of being seen, which is pretty
similar. Is there any difference?
I guess they're all similar, but it's, you know, and it's to do with people, right? And it's to do with culture, actually. Big one, and I know that the peeps will relate to this, is the fear of social awkwardness. Like me, you would think from my anxiety reactions that a socially awkward situation, you might as well be flaying me alive. Like, I treat the possibility of a long awkward silence with someone I don't know very well as though I would not survive it. So funny. School pickups. Oh, don't even talk to me. I'm like, oh, I don't have any mum friends.
I wonder why.
It's so funny. I thought that you were kind of a fragile being at one time. And then I watched you going through medical treatments and like enduring things that are incredibly physically painful. And you're like, so what?
I didn't have to talk to anyone.
It's a flesh wound. And I'm like, how can you do that? And you're like, I didn't have to talk. Yeah, but it's true. You don't talk to the other moms when you go to pick up our little one.
Yeah, I will try and extend myself in that area. What's yours? What are your things where you don't have high tolerance for discomfort and anxiety?
Similar. It all has to do with other people, sometimes animals. But I'm not afraid of animals in the usual way. I wouldn't mind if an animal killed me, but I would be very, very upset if an animal were disappointed. I'm not kidding. I cannot stand to see someone or something feeling disappointed. I'm okay with being disappointed, but to watch another being feel disappointed is, you know, it's like being flayed alive. And actually, Lila picked up on this, our two-year-old, because when she has tantrums, you'll sometimes talk about her feelings with her to help her name them. Oh, it's so disappointing when you wanted to go outside and it's getting dark and you can't go out. And the other day she was having a grandma, and she practices tantrums. You can hear her in her room going, woo, woo,
and then, literally looking in the mirror.
Yeah, and then getting to a full throat. That would like, she could be rented out for special effects in movies.
Can I just tell them something that's totally unrelated?
Yes.
So in the bath, when she has a bath, sorry, Americans, a bath, when she goes in the tub.
Say bath. Never stop saying bath.
I won't. Lila says bath too. I love it. So there's, what is it? It's like the thing, it's like a tap, I guess, if I wanted to give it a term, a faucet type thing. But there's a silver metal round circle that the tap lives in. Okay. I'm sure that's not the technical term, but you know.
That's what plumbers call it.
She can see her reflection in this circle
when
she stands in the bath. And parents, you know, we don't encourage standing in the bath at this age. Or ever, like, what are you doing? Lie down. Aren't you tired?
I found you lying in the bath today.
She stands there watching herself cry. And if I put my hand over it to block her view, she gets even more distraught, tries to push it away so that she can watch herself cry while standing in the bath. I mean, she's so her mother's daughter. And the other day I was like, come on, Lila, sit down. We've got to wash your hair. And she said, no, mummy, I'm crying white now.
That was me. That you're confusing us. I was saying that.
Sorry. I just, well, it's funny. It's cute.
It is funny. And the other day when she was really in the midst of like a full shrieking, lying on the ground, she screams almost incoherently, "I'm so disappointed."
You've forgotten the context of that. That was in response to having to have her diaper change.
Oh, that's true.
And she was just so disappointed in us.
I'm so disappointed. I was so hoping to keep this urine-soaked rag against my skin for a bit longer. And I was like, no, I'm going to take it and put it against my skin. Anyway, I know that was...
fuck was that?
It was a bridge too far. That's what it was.
That's what it was.
A bridge too far.
Several bridges.
Anything where, especially if I haven't met people's expectations, the thought that people will see me as not having done enough, oh my God, unbearable anxiety. And the only one that comes from like inside me is the fear of being exhausted. Like physically exhausted, like sleep deprived as you are now. Mm-hmm. And I'd have to say those two things are related as I think about it, that my fear of being fatigued probably goes along with my absolute dread of letting any creature ever be disappointed as long as I live. Yeah.
I don't get it.
It exhausts me.
Oh, okay.
So I'm exhausted.
How does fear of fatigue, like, do you not go out for a walk or something because you're so scared you'll feel fatigued?
I do things,
but how does it affect your behavior?
Mainly it keeps me from traveling.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, that makes total sense. Yep.
I've been unbelievably torturously exhausted on the various book tours and speaking tours I used to do, and it built up a fear of exhaustion that is really quite debilitating.
Right, and that's the because it went into the cycle thing where it was reinforced by the situation that kept surrounding it. That's fascinating.
Once, like, collapsed in an airport, woke up in a hospital, that kind of thing. I mean, it was pretty major. See, look, but
listen, you're trying to make it like, but it's a totally justified fear because I woke up in a hospital, da 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 da. Did you catch that? Like, instead of going, yeah, this is a big anxiety, you're like, it's a totally rational anxiety.
You make a solid point. I just wanted the people to know I'm not a wimp.
Fear of being seen. Wimp. Where is it? Fear of being seen as not doing enough was the one you mentioned.
Damn
beforehand.
You, Rowan Mangan! You use my words against me. There are some, though, that I've gotten over, which goes to the point of this episode. You can get over these things. Mm. And like, I used to be afraid, and I think this is huge in our culture, of being wrong.
Right. I think the academic system really trains people in that direction, right? That ego gets very attached to being right. And you can totally see how people wouldn't put themselves in a situation where they could be tested and found wrong.
Looks stupid. Yeah. And that, you're right. It's total ego food, and it makes you, and having both of us spent quite a bit of time in the system of academia, you see people, I mean, one of my favorite examples of this is when I wrote in my book, Expecting Adam, about how once I went into a Harvard seminar of psychologists or sociologists, and I'd been visiting a psychologist friend in her lab, and she was swimming rats around for this particular experiment. And she had a kid's pool with these little blue cartoons called Smurfs. And I came into this seminar at Harvard and I said, "Sorry, I'm late. I was upstairs watching them swim rats around in the Smurf pool." And they thought I meant a psychologist named Smurf. So then they all started talking about Smurf's latest work and how they'd all read it.
It's brilliant.
And how they knew all about it. And everyone was afraid to not know who Smurf was.
Yeah, the emperor has no clothes.
Anyway, so yeah, all those fears of looking stupid and all of that, I just, at a certain point, well, when my son was born he has Down syndrome, and I was like, what was I thinking? Of course I don't know things. I don't know anything. And I just sort of came out with it. And that kind of goes to our whole point about the way culture trains us to deal with these anxieties and the way nature would have us do.
Well, it's interesting because, I mean, I wonder in the same way if that cycle that you were describing in the brain, where this goes to that, feeds back to that, feeds into that, and ramps mm-hmm. up the anxiety all the time. I feel like culture and ego right. Do the same thing in a destructive, but I want to say positive in the sense of with a plus, not
yeah, an increasing way.
Yes, yeah. Yeah. And I feel like when we're talking about courage, we also need to be talking about humility to a certain extent, and that's where yeah. that ego culture comes in, because when we are pushing up against a tendency for our lives to get smaller, and now we're getting into Brené Brown territory, as we always end up there because she's so mm-hmm. brilliant, but you know, where you are, you do get to a point where vulnerability, the vulnerability of risking being wrong.
Yeah.
You know, and you have to start making those kind of calculations of it's worth risking being wrong for the richness that these experiences start to bring to my life.
Yeah. And the honesty, the sort of landing in reality instead of living in this artificially safe world, artificially safe. It's the that metaphor about the king who wanted to cover his kingdom in leather so that nothing would ever hurt his feet. And a shoemaker came along and said, why don't we put some leather on your feet? And the leather on your feet is courage and humility. Mm. Yeah.
So we've sort of touched on what the culture would say about this, but like, let's be explicit. So
it really is about avoiding discomfort. Like, this should be comfortable. Everything should be comfortable. We've developed the option of being so comfortable, as you said, like every company is trying to edge out every other company and making everything more convenient, everything easier, everything less challenging. And there's
I really believe that our tolerance for discomfort gets so tiny that we start mistaking convenience and safety. Like we start thinking, if this is less convenient, I should be afraid.
Right, right. Oh, and also we're able to be in little small groups of people now because the internet lets us reach out. So we're not bumping around with a whole bunch of really diverse people.
Yeah, that's right. And
we talk about diversity.
Echo chamber thing.
But there are so many echo chambers online, and you don't have to like try to figure out what someone's saying in a strange accent. You know, it's like, or they're using a different vocabulary than yours. And that, because it's more convenient to be with people who don't challenge your thoughts or ideas at all.
Right. Oh, the obvious one is different politics.
Yeah.
Ooh, from me.
And you know, I am not a great one for going out and seeking conversation online with people who don't agree with my politics.
Same here, babe.
But by the same token, you know, I had an appointment with my foot doctor, and my foot doctor started expressing completely different politics from mine. And I literally was like afraid there in the office. Mm. And I had to ask myself, am I seeing this person as a human? Am I bringing my humility and my courage here? Because I'm really uncomfortable with this and I wish I could just get away from it.
Oh my God, that is such a good point. I have a fear reaction to seeing some of those flags and stuff that you see people put outside their houses. That terrifies me. And it's ridiculous that it terrifies me, because ultimately, you know, there's a fundamental, well, maybe not fundamental, there's a disagreement there. But if it starts to feel fundamental, doesn't it? Because it's a really good example, Maddie, of we're not challenging ourselves in that way, and we are starting to experience fear. And that said, I'm not hugely interested in extending myself in that precise way.
Nor am I, but that actually isn't our point. Our point here is that there's an underlying assumption that discomfort is not something we should have to tolerate, any kind of psychological discomfort or physical discomfort for that matter. So the culture basically puts into each head of ours the thought, if I'm uncomfortable, I'm either in totally the wrong place, or something should be done to make me completely comfortable. Right. I need to be comfortable. I deserve to be comfortable all the time. And discomfort is a sign that something's really, really wrong.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
God. And since life isn't comfortable, when you have the message in your head, discomfort is dangerous, you're going to be uncomfortable. And if you interpret that as danger, you're going to be so anxious.
So inconvenience is going to drive you into a tiny zone of safety.
Yeah, well,
inconvenience itself can contribute to this growing.
All the things we want: ease, lavishness, care, self-care, tenderness, all these things that are really genuinely, positively, wonderfully good. If you refuse to accept discomfort and you say, this is all I will experience, you will, the discomfort of anxiety will follow you in, and it will make your self-care scary to you. It will literally pollute absolutely everything. And Nias Nin was absolutely right. It will shrink your life in proportion to your courage. And the message is, you shouldn't have to keep your life big. Your life should just be big and comfortable at the same time without you having to do anything, which would be lovely.
Someone else's responsibility.
Yeah. And that would be lovely, but it's impossible because of the way our brains work. We have to follow nature. So, like, I think we should move on to what we think about that.
All right, let's do that in just a moment.
I've always been weird. When I write and speak professionally, I have to tone it down, especially the part where I believe the universe loves us and is on our side. A few years ago, I decided to just show up online and say what I really think. This became The Gathering Pod, a series of discussions about how to thrive in a difficult world. So if you need hope, inspiration, or a chance to listen to someone much weirder than you could ever be, come join me on The Gathering Pod.
So how do we figure it out? We've seen what culture says, but what does nature say?
First of all, you know, we talk about nature culture, and nature is like this whole romantic image of like dancing around in fields full of butterflies while squirrels feed us nuts. Nature is actually, Mother Nature is a generous and infinite source, but she is not easy. She doesn't coddle. Nature doesn't coddle us.
Mm.
Mother Nature can actually be a heartless bitch, or seem to be.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's that sort of indifference. It's not, the world's not interested in making your path soft for your little feet.
Mm-hmm.
We just read a novel that just reminded us about it, which was just like, you know, survival out in the woods in difficult circumstances. And it was like, oh yeah, no, there's a lot of different ways that you can just die.
Oh, like you can die so fast. Like at one point it's just raining and they're too tired. The characters in the novel are too tired to change their clothes because they've been running from things. And they know if they can't change their clothes, they'll die in 3 hours of hypothermia. Like, you don't think about that stuff till you're out there. And then it's really clear.
I'm starting to see more and more why people just stay in their room.
Remember when we went to see the Redwood Forest in California?
Yes,
and
I do.
Like, and I'd been living out, we'd been living out near nature, and we were driving on this desolate thing. And what did I need? I needed something.
I feel like it was cream or something like that.
Yeah, like antibiotic cream. I cut myself.
No, I think it was heavy cream.
Oh, like to eat.
Yeah.
And we went looking, and I was like, in this entire redwood forest, and these trees were here, you know, when Moses was leading the children of Israel, and yet there is no cream to be had. And I remember saying to you, I'm all about nature until I need something.
It's a classic Martha Beck moment.
Yeah. Oh, so God. Nature doesn't say you're supposed to be comfortable at all.
No.
But nature does give you appetites, a brain that teaches you to go looking for things that are going to keep you alive. So it gives you a cautious nature, but also a drive to explore. And I think what nature is asking us all the time, even when we're living comfortably in our houses, our inner nature is saying, explore the limits of your desires. And life isn't safe. So be aware of that and pay attention and proceed with caution. But you must continue to explore, or I will kill you. That's what nature is saying. Because if you never go anywhere or do anything, you're going to starve to death or die of thirst or whatever.
And also soul death. I mean, that's what we're really talking about. Once anxiety and fear has made your life tiny, then the richness is gone. It starts getting super beige in there.
Not even beige. It turns dark. It can get very, very dark in a brain that is just focused on anxiety. I've been to those places where anxiety starts to blend with depression. So there is a complete leaden inability to move on top of constant, you know, shrieking level fear. It actually is hell.
Yeah.
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 That's life without courage. Without discomfort, without the willingness to brave discomfort, becomes hell. It chases you.
So culture says, be proud of yourself if you've eliminated discomfort, right? Mm-hmm, but nature would say, be proud if you explore discomfort.
Ooh.
Is that it?
I think that's true. I think that's exactly right. And I think, I mean, we do see it with our kid, where she's constantly wanting to go to the uncomfortable. Like there is a drive in her toward things that have hurt her before. But I think when we're little, it's stronger. In all baby animals, the urge to explore is strong. That's an interesting thing, because the very impulse in the left side of our brain that goes toward fear, in the right side of the brain, if we choose that, is more curious and exploratory. So we're actually switching, but that we'll leave that for a more detailed discussion in books and programs and things. But it's exactly right that nature is asking us to be careful of our safety, but it's also saying explore, 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 move outward. There's a reason human beings go everywhere and climb everything and go down to the bottom of the ocean. It's a strong part of our nature. And I think finding a balance, like the culture right now, a lot of culture, and I think advertising culture is a big part of this, like you said, is I should never be uncomfortable, not ever. And nature says, learn when being uncomfortable is useful to expand your comfort zone, and learn when being uncomfortable is a signal that you have to withdraw. And there's a difference. There's a fine qualitative difference that we do not find because we're so conveniencized. We're so comfortable.
That's really interesting, because instead of just talking about courage, now you're actually talking about a skill that can be developed, a sort of sense of the difference between danger and discomfort.
It's so interesting. I like going down to South Africa to our friends there. Our friends, the Vardis, have lived in the bush in South Africa for a long time. And I remember going out for a little Jeep jaunt with Boyd Vardy driving once. And we came around a corner and an elephant attacked us, like full on, trumpeting, ears flapping. It was loud and it was close. And Boyd switched into reverse, looked back the way you do, and he backed off saying, it's okay, friend, it's okay. So there was that. And then one day we were just sitting with them on the deck with the whole family, and I didn't hear or see anything. And every single one of them turned like a herd of gazelles toward a sound. And they were like, what's that? And they all went up and looked over the deck, and there was a leopard there, and there was a child there. And yeah, wow. It was like they had learned the difference between being calm because there's an elephant attacking you, but it doesn't really mean business, right to the birds just stopped chirping, or they gave an alarm call under a bush over there. And that means there's a cobra over there. And there could be it is a skill that can be learned, and nature teaches it to humans. But when we're out of the context of nature, we have more trouble finding that instinct, I think.
Oh my God, I love that so much. And it just reinforces the idea of the only way to hone that ability is to continuously expose yourself to different kinds of experiences. You know, that you know, we shall not cease from exploration. Like if we're always exploring, then it's almost like that in itself will keep us sharp. And I was just suddenly thought about, you know, in The Artist's Way, Julia Cameron, she talks about going on an artist date, taking off by yourself once a week and going and doing something different, walking down a different street, going to a place you don't usually go. And it's almost just like it could be as simple as that. You know, not that I'm getting prescriptive, but I just think whenever we walk down a different street, we think different thoughts, we're actually honing those instincts, right?
You're absolutely right, because when I'm talking about the left hemisphere amygdala, what triggers it is not, well, it triggers both the amygdala, but not necessarily danger, but unfamiliarity. So it can be turned into either fear or curiosity and exploration, and seeing something different will trigger it. And that's like, a way,
Sorry, it's like that thing with a puppy, when you get a puppy and there's like, it's a really good idea to, before they're 6 months old, expose them to all these different things, like walk, have them walk between two parked cars, have them encounter someone on crutches or someone with a long skirt, someone with a hat on, someone with a beard, and have these different experiences, because the way that their brains develop, probably very similar to ours, is if you hit 6 months, which I guess is a point of maturity in their brain or development, then they have to treat the unfamiliar as potentially dangerous.
And their brains are a lot like ours, with one and like many other social primates, but I think I've talked about this before. Our brains are different in one crucially, brilliantly fascinating way. And that is, we have a mutation called neoteny, which means the preservation of the new. In other animals, there's an abrupt cutoff of learning and the curiosity of babyhood that comes when they hit like puberty. In our case, the reason we look different from other apes, we look like baby monkeys. When you see chimpanzees or monkeys on TV, they'll often be the babies because they're more attractive to us. They look more like we do. Flat faces, they don't have jutting jaws. They don't have really heavy, overhanging brows. We don't have fangs. We have little teeth, and we show them to each other and smiles to say, I won't bite you, the way baby monkeys do. We never hit the point where the brain stops maturing unless we stop learning. Unless we stop having new experience.
Okay. So is there a mirror image thing here then with the making the world bigger in the neoteny and the continuous learning? Is that a mirror image analogy to the cycle of the world becoming smaller and smaller if we don't? Because it's like, what's the opposite of learning? It's like every day contracting.
Yeah, and it's not unlearning. There's this unlearning thing where you unlearn what culture teaches you, but then there's unlearning that is like, I forgot that I used to have fun doing something because I haven't done it for so long. It's withered. It's not just that you've unlearned it. It literally withers. The neural connections in the brain wither like plants. So yeah, you're absolutely right. You can start to use curiosity and as a compulsion almost to lean into discomfort. So if you really want something or you're really curious about something and it scares you, leaning into the discomfort and staying present with the discomfort. This is what a lot of meditation is about, staying present with discomfort until that fear response calms down, is how you make yourself, your world bigger.
I got a meditation for you.
Okay.
Close your eyes, take a deep breath, and imagine that your coffee has been put on a cup warmer for the first time. You take a deep sip of lovely warm coffee. You haven't touched it for a little while, but you know it'll be warm. Unbeknownst to you, a skin has formed on the top of your cup of coffee because it's warm, right? And so, and also just imagine in this visualization that you're doing a podcast in this moment.
Wait. I got it. Okay. I got it.
All right. Yeah. So now there's a long brown skin hanging out of your mouth. Oh, luckily someone else is talking right now, so you're able to save it. Lean into this milky skin.
I have a slab of milk skin.
Just lean
on my
into
chin.
The discomfort. It's great.
Exactly. You know, here's the thing. Your life is getting bigger right now because if we can just get you to just stay with this, you'll be able, I can see right now the slab of coffee milk skin on your cheek. And see, no, don't wipe it away. Don't lean into it. Just be with it.
This would never happen in a tiny house.
Just be with the milky skin.
I'm so sorry for derailing, but I just couldn't let that go completely unacknowledged because it was a big thing just happened to me.
There's actually a story that Liz Gilbert tells in her book, Big Magic, about a man who had to be with discomfort. He was an artist. He went to Paris to study. He was a penniless artist or whatever. And he went to a party that was hosted by his patron, who was a wealthy woman.
You've told this on the podcast before, but it bears repeating.
Okay. And it was a costume party. And he went and got this amazing lobster costume. He was like a human-sized lobster. And he had these big claws and everything. And he went into the party of all these wealthy people. And it was a Louis XIV costume party. Everyone was dressed in brocades and silks and wigs and whatever. And he was a lobster. And he had to make a decision right there. Do I flee from this party? Or do I go in and take it like a man and a woman or whatever? And he went in. And he was the life of the party.
The reason that story is so funny is that it's also operating on an American in Europe.
Yes.
social moray type stuff, right?
Anyway, the whole point is that what makes you safe in the world is your ability to tolerate discomfort until you can learn what actually is dangerous. And that is what makes you safe. The will to explore until you know for sure.
Oh my God. The ability to trust yourself to tell the difference between discomfort and danger. Right. Trusting yourself in that, that's how you are safe.
And is there a risk? Doesn't that mean there's a risk that you could go too far? Yes. That's nature. There will always, always, always be a risk that you could go, that something could hurt you. And if you just stay in your tiny room, your tiny house for the rest of your life, if you're a van or whatever, nature's still going to come get you. You're going to die. So yeah, there's a level of risk that is necessary to exercise courage. It's not foolishness, but the way you stay safe is to be willing to explore until you get a keener and keener sense of what's real danger and what is actually just unfamiliarity.
Right. And then the reason we keep exploring, which we haven't even kind of touched on in this podcast, is for all the things that life is, all the experiences and the richness of what it is to be alive. So, you know, we're moving into our discomfort, but it's in the direction of our deepest longing. It's in the direction of our dreams, you know?
Yeah,
it's like towards all that makes life remarkable.
Yeah, and that makes us, that makes life risky, but I'm going to do another thing I've done before on the podcast, which is to quote Helen Keller, who said, life is either a daring adventure or nothing.
Yeah.
You want some life, you've got to walk right into discomfort, taste every flavor, right, of discomfort and sit with it, like savor it.
Become a connoisseur of discomfort, because that's called life experience.
Yeah. And you talk about the small acts of courage.
Right. Yeah. And that's stopping your life getting small.
Yeah. Being brave. And it can be like, so I'll tell you what I will do right after we get off this recording. I'm actually going to email a person I should have emailed a long time ago. And every day that I haven't emailed this person, I become more anxious. And it's become almost intolerable for me to even think about it. But I'm going to go email them.
Great.
That's my act of courage.
I'm gonna stare down this cup of coffee and maybe talk to a parent at a school pickup.
little by little, it you start to branch out. And actually, if you can get the trend shifting away from shrinking into growing, it does at a certain point pick up some momentum and you start to have a richer life. And it's not comfort that makes it, it's courage.
Right. And like one thing I want to do is is come to value courage more in myself in this sort of context as something that I can claim and practice and that can be a thing about me is that I practice courage.
Mm. And even value, what I'm taking away from this is everybody values courage, you know, at least in name, but I want to value my discomfort. As long as it's in the direction of my longing, I want to say, like when I'm in meditation, here comes a feeling, this is really uncomfortable. How valuable this is going to be. I'm going to sit here and I'm going to like let it soak through me until I...
Oh, I'm just thinking of that skin. The coffee soaking through me. Sorry.
Ugh. Stay with it, Ro. Stay with it. I'm gonna come in where you are as soon as we're done with this and just put coffee skins all over you. And it's going to be so enriching.
Oh, my God. And
your courage and your discomfort are going to be legendary.
Oh, I can only imagine. Well, I'll try to be brave.
Okay, so all y'all out there, stay brave, lean into discomfort, make your comfort grow,
and
stay wild.
We hope you're enjoying Bewildered. If you're in the USA and want to be notified when a new episode comes out, text the word WILD to 570-873-0144. We're also on Instagram. Our handle is Bewildered Podcast. You can follow us to get updates, hear funny snippets and outtakes, and chat with other fans of the show. Bewildered is produced by Scott Forster with support from the brilliant team at MBI. And remember, if you're having fun, please rate and review. And stay wild.
You know, what I'm seeing out in the world is a lot of fear and a growing amount of despair. Maybe you're feeling that way too, because the ways our culture has taught us to navigate the world, to navigate our lives, they are failing us. We need a new language. We need a new set of tools to find our way individually and as a group. And I know we can still do this. I put everything I do know about it into Wayfinder Life Coach Training. And the tools that I teach there are to help people redefine how we relate to each other, how we make a living, how we do community. We can only change the world for the better if we redefine how we think. And the world needs Wayfinders now more than ever. So please go to marthabeck.com and you'll find your way.